This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1036, A Conversation with Ariana Marr. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. I'm your host, Adam Chapin, and this is episode 1036, A Conversation with Ariana Marr. Ariana works for the virtual calligraphy lettering studio that Chris Heliopoulos put together quite some time ago now. You can go back and listen to my recent episode with Chris Heliopoulos, where we actually get into the founding of this kind of lettering collective. So that's a good starter if you want to kind of have an understanding of what virtual calligraphy is. That was back in episode 1032, which came out back in March. But this episode was really interesting. Ariana was really forthcoming and had some great stories to tell, but kind of breaking into the industry. I do recommend that you do check out her blog. I do mention it during the episode, and honestly, it's a really interesting resource. It's ArianaMarr.com, so ArianaMaher.com. So I highly recommend people check that out. The blog post in particular are really fascinating. I do mention it during the course of this discussion, but there's some really interesting things there that we do go a little bit in detail on, but I do recommend you check them out so you can get a better understanding of exactly what I'm talking to her about. But Ariana has been working in comics for a long time, but to varying degrees, as she kind of mentions, and now as virtual calligraphy, does a lot of Marvel work. So this was a really fun and interesting conversation. I'm really finding it fascinating talking to people who are letterers or, you know, just because, as I mentioned here, it is so overlooked so often. And I think in my last episode with Jam and Mateus, which is actually recorded after this episode with Ariana, I kind of mentioned how, you know, it's one of those things where you know bad lettering, but you don't, your mind almost won't pick up on good lettering, which is such a weird psychological thing. Like, you notice if it's bad, but if it's good, you almost don't notice it, which is so criminal, because these people who work in lettering are so tremendously talented, and they have so many decisions they have to make, and to kind of thread that line to make sure that it's, you know, the lettering choices really support the story. So anyways, I find the more I think about it, the more I learn about it, the more fascinated I am by that industry and how people operate within it. And Ariana, again, was a fantastic interview to really get into the weeds a little bit for someone who is relatively newer to the industry. It was also interesting because it turns out we're born the same year, so we have some of the same touchstones. So there's a brief mention of Age of Apocalypse, and I was like, yeah, I love Age of Apocalypse, because we're definitely the same kind of peer group in that respect. And that actually, it was funny because I was thinking about it. I was like, you know, for the most part, I've always, you know, the creators who work in comics have always been older than me. And now I'm at that cresting point where now they're getting to be younger than me or the same age, because I just turned 40. And so newer voices in the industry or people kind of coming up now are not older than me anymore. Now they're younger than me. And that's an interesting change. It's kind of like, you know, in my work life, working with people who predominantly were always older than me. I work at a bank. I started at the bank when I was 23 years old. Everyone was always older than me. And so even though I've been at the bank 17 years now, which is a long time, a lot of people have still been there longer, but now there's a lot of people who are there younger. And I recently had an interaction where, you know, I was working with a manager of a branch, not my manager, but we were basically the same age, within a week actually. And I was like, oh, like, that's different. Like, I was just used to a certain hierarchy and it was always someone older. So it's interesting how that starts to change as you get older in life. Anyways, that has nothing to do with Ariana, but it's just a quick diatribe about aging. Yeah, that's what you come to the Comic Shenanigans podcast for. Anyways, thank you so much for downloading this episode. I really appreciate it. If you're new to the show, make sure to check out our back catalog. There's a lot of great interviews that have been on the channel, or on, I guess, the show. In terms of what's coming up soon, I'm really excited. We're supposed to have Joe Rubenstein coming on soon, who's a legendary Inker. Who else we got coming up? We have Pat Olive, who's supposed to be coming on the show soon, Mark Russell, and a bunch of others that we're still kind of working on dates for, but I'm very excited to have more people on the show. At the end of April, we're going to have our next Book of the Month Club episode as we continue to mine the Spider-Man clone saga as we move into the next phase, which is the Web of Life, Web of Death, and Smoke and Mirrors chapter. So we're getting just up to Aunt May's death, but not quite getting to Aunt May's death, which will obviously be a big moment. Anyways, yeah, so thanks for downloading. That's stuff that's coming up soon in the upcoming episodes. And you can always email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com. Rate the show on iTunes, subscribe to us on iTunes, and listen to us on Spotify. Thanks again for listening, and here is the interview with Ariana. Enjoy. Ariana, welcome to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. It's been a busy day, but it's been a beautiful day.
That's good. So I want to go way back. Obviously I'm very excited to talk about your work in lettering and comics, and also working obviously for virtual calligraphy. But when did comics first become part of your world? Because lettering is an interesting profession in general. So I'm always curious how people come to it, but also if you had an earlier experience with comic books, or if that came later.
I'd say my first real encounter with comics, the thing that really pulled me into comics, was Uncanny X-Men 303.
Okay.
It was an issue that Chris lettered, actually. It's the one where Ileana Rasputin passes away.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a really amazing, it had an incredible cover. It had Jubilee and Jean Grey crying on the cover. And I was a kid who watched the cartoon series, so I'm like, oh my gosh, why are some of my favorite characters crying? And I read the issue, and it was like, oh my gosh. So that got me hooked into reading X-Men comics. And the only thing that pulled me away from comics was when my family, military family, we moved overseas. Mm. And there was very little comics I could buy. We were in Japan, so I got into manga instead.
Mm.
But comics was always that thing that if I got a chance, I would get back into. So... and that's pretty much what kicked it off for me.
When you were reading, when you read an issue like that, I'm always curious what prompts people to kind of pick things up off the stands when they're younger. Because as you said, if your entry point is X-Men, the animated series, which I think for me and X-Men is probably the same. I was born in 83, so I would have been the right age, 9 years old when the X-Men animated series comes out. I don't think I was buying X-Men comics at the time. I think I read afterwards. So I'm curious, what prompts you to kind of pick up that issue at all? Was it just because it was so arresting?
I was also born in 83, so we were both the perfect age for that. it was definitely seeing Jubilee and Jean Grey on the cover. I remember it distinctly because we were at Price Club, which I guess is old Costco.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to take big stacks of comics and saran wrap them into a block, and you could buy the block of single issues. And there they were at the top of that block, so I begged my mom. She bought me this whole block of Marvel comics. And the thing that got me hooked was all the X-Men issues. Mm-hmm. And so after that, we would just go to the local comic book store, because this is before we moved overseas at the time. And she would give me $5 every Wednesday on her way to the market. And I would buy whatever issue I really wanted and then save my change for the next. And I still, to this day, do not know how I managed to collect all of Age of Apocalypse at the time it was coming out. I don't know if I begged during Christmas or something like that, but that was my big epic thing for me. That was my Star Wars.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that is incredibly impactful. I'm jealous of you because I did not get to read them all when they first came out. I only had a few issues. I had Weapon X, I think, issues issue 2, and I had Astonishing 1 and 4. It was just whatever I was finding on spinner racks. So I was just trying to get everything I could. So I'm very jealous. My, 12-year-old self is very jealous of you.
Honestly, it was part of what kept me sane after we moved overseas at night. There wasn't any bookstores on base, and all the bookstores off base were in Japanese, and I couldn't read Japanese yet. So it was oh, what do I do? So I would reread and reread over all the comics I had collected up until that point, and that's pretty much all I did.
So I'm curious, like, at what point did you think about, like, I think everyone who reads comics at one point thinks, well, I could do this, or I could do that, or in my case, I definitely couldn't be an artist. Like, I knew I had no aptitude that way, but I was like, oh, maybe I could write, or maybe I could do something like that. I never pursued it because I'm just not talented enough. But when did you kind of decide this is, like, somewhere I'd like to be? And I should mention, you have a fantastic blog post that really details kind of what it's like to try and kind of break through the industry and how long and arduous it can be and the pitfalls of what it can entail. So I'm just curious at what point you started even, you know, that prolonged entry into comics.
Oh my gosh, you read my blog post. Wow. I didn't know anyone read those. Yeah. It was one of those things, like, I think for a lot of kids in our generation, that when you're in, like, middle school and high school, you'll team up with your friend who could maybe, like, draw a little bit, or you could write a little bit, and you try to put together a comic of your own. Mm-hmm. We definitely tried that. We never speak of it again. It was pretty embarrassing. But it did make me think, man, comics are interesting, and comics are so cool. But then, in good time, I realized I just wasn't as interested with writing or with art as much as I thought I was. I ended up channeling all of my energy into studying Japanese and becoming a translator. But when I achieved that dream years and years later, like graduated college and got a job at Kawasaki and I was a translator, I realized that job was not for me.
Oh, really?
And it was a pretty low point for me because I liked the people I worked with. I liked some of the stuff that we did, but I realized I just didn't feel confident in what I was doing. And as a way to de-stress, by that point, I could speak and read Japanese, so I could go to the bookstores. But I ended up traveling halfway across Tokyo 2 or 3 times a week.
Wow.
To go to this comic book store called Blister. It's over in Asakusa. And there was, like, one of the only comic book stores I know in Tokyo that sells Western comics in English. And that's where I'd go. I'd, like, pick up some Western comics and I'd read it. And one day I was reading, I had picked up the tome, I think it's Understanding Comics.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard about it?
Yes, of course, yeah, with Scott McCloud, right?
Exactly. And there's this one page I'll never forget where he explains the lettering process. And he shows this diagram of lettering as if it were, like, the layers of a sandwich, mm-hmm. you know? And how the layer of lettering sits on top of the colors and sits on top of the art. And how that tells parts of the story. And I thought, man, that's interesting. And so in the process of me working my day job and stressing out and enjoying comics, I found myself once again making fan comics with yet another friend, except this time I wasn't doing art. I wasn't drawing or anything. I just wanted to help her. So I learned Adobe Illustrator and I made the lettering for her comic on, like, DeviantArt or whatever. And it was fun. And it was difficult because there's no tutorials out there at the time. Mm. There was no Nate Gakos to write a tome to explain all the details of lettering. You just had to experiment until you figured out how, you know, and found what tutorials you could. And I think Jim Campbell did online blog where he explains everything in a kind of a tutorial. And it's pretty pared down, especially at the time. It's probably too dated now to use, but I think a whole generation of us letterers ended up using that. Me, Aditya Bidikar, I think Hassan also had used it. Lucas, definitely. Like, often when I talk to a lot of, like, letterers that have come in from the past few years, like I have, mm-hmm. they're like, oh, yeah, the Jim Campbell blogs. That's how I learned.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
When you did read Nate Picos's book, which again was after you were kind of already kind of doing lettering, did that feel like a moment of being able to feel like you were finally seen, like finally letterers and what they were doing and their art was finally actually being seen by others? Because it does feel like one of those things that people take for granted. And I have to admit this a little bit to, for myself, like, you know, I've talked with Tom Orzechowski before, and that was really impactful. But I think it was only relatively recently when I talked to Richard Starkings, and I really started to get my eyes open to the actual art of everything he was talking about. And I feel embarrassed that it took me that long to get to that point. So when you see a book like Picos has come out, and people are really responding to it, did it make you feel very seen?
I felt ecstatic. It's like a moment where you feel very validated, but there's ways I feel validated in my work, and it's not from readers, because I know a lot, or reviewers, because I know readers and reviewers will not notice the lettering unless the lettering's really bad. So if they bring up my name, I'm kind of sweating a little bit. It's like, oh no, what have I done? I get my validation from the editors I work with and fellow letterers when they're like, hey, that was a cool thing you did there. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And for Nate to make a book that explains not just the lettering process, but like how it's like to be a freelancer in the industry, how it is to read a comic and understand what goes into the lettering. There's like so many elements to that book that I think really works for everyone. That's why I did, I think my first blog post that I posted up on my portfolio site was a reading guide for that book.
That's right.
Because I think everyone could get something out of that book, not just people who are learning how to letter. And I especially hope that like reviewers read it, and especially those pages I highlighted, because, man, he really points out the stuff that are like, what letters see is good lettering.
For sure. Actually, I do have to say that your post was fascinating to see how you broke it down and by like which segments of people would find it most impactful and how it would inform them. So it was a really interesting kind of not annotation, but you know what I mean, like an expansion of the text, and as a way to make it more impactful and to make it mean more for different types of people who might read it. So I thought that was actually a really interesting post that you put together and really well thought out. Like the level of detail you went into, it showed how much that book meant to you, but also how much you wanted it to mean to others.
Yeah. And I really hope this is a book that will carry on for many years for people, because I know a lot of people have asked me in the industry, and I'm sure they ask other letterers too. It's like, oh, how do you letter? How do you break in? How does one do this? And that's always now I can finally be like, hey, look here. Instead of just like, well, there's this tutorial, and I guess you can look at Jim Campbell's blog, but that's from an older version of Adobe. I don't know how that's going to work. And it's much easier now.
For sure.
I ended up using a chunk of my vacation annotating that book just for that post, for no one's sake other than my own. It was like an itch I had to scratch to do that. So I just like used my vacation time on the hammock, like scribbling that out.
Have you told Nate how much you loved his book?
I have, yes. I think he knows who I am. I have never got to meet him in person, but I do have a signed copy of his book that I got in a special, like, he was promoting it when the book first came out. So that's one of my treasures.
I guess we should mention the full title of the book is The Essential Guide to Comic Book Lettering by Nate Picos, if people do want to check it out, because it is a great read. It's very informative. And again, if you want to check out your blog, it really breaks down how to read it.
Yes. It's at myname.com, ArianaMar.com. There's like a blog section. And if you scroll down to the bottom, it's like a full reading guide. So if you review comics and you want to get some more insight on how to spot when the lettering is good as opposed to when the lettering is bad, that's a really good spot to I list the specific pages for you to read and like get insight on that.
That's great. So let's go back again, your kind of personal history. So you've kind of start kind of lettering for fun or in the side to help others. When did it be, I mean, and you do detail this in your blog, but for those who haven't read it, like, when did you start to make that shift? And obviously it was a long shift to kind of trying to make it a primary thing, but what was that process like for you? And was it, I mean, obviously it's difficult because it takes time, but was it something that you still felt very passionate about throughout, or what was that process to you know, get more regular work?
I think it took me, like, I was doing here and there. I had one big project that was just 6 months after me learning, and it was a little too soon for me to work on a title like that, and I had a difficulty in advocating for myself, so I got kind of burned by the situation. Mm-hmm. You know, didn't get paid well, didn't get handled well, and it was just like, ugh.
Can
so
I ask which book
I
it was?
I kind of retreated. Oh, jeez. I'm not trying to be secretive. I forget. I think it's called The Intrepids.
Okay.
Yeah. It was one of those kind of books where the writer, Curtis, I forget his name. He's not in the industry anymore. I think he works video games now. He was basically the person that you had to call to talk to about anything, like kind of like as you would the editor, but he never responded to emails. So I was just kind of left adrift a lot of times, especially when it came down to, hey, am I going to be paid for this? Stuff like that. And he made it feel like he was doing me a favor and he was giving me exposure. So isn't that great? And at the same time, that exposure pretty much equated to at least one reviewer on IGN complaining about me every single issue that came out.
No.
It's like, oh, this comic is great, but the letterers suck. And I was like, ah. Oh. So it wasn't really an exposure I wanted either. So I don't know. It's not anything controversial for me to say it wasn't a good experience. It's just, it's not anything to dogpile on someone over, because it's over. God, it's like a decade ago. But it was something that showed me from the start that I could avoid being in these kind of situations if I was a greater advocate for myself. So I ended up kind of deciding to, you know, just work on things for friends, just do things for friends. And it was my friends who were like, no, you have to actually be paid. We're actually going to pay you for this. And I was like, oh, right, that's great. So I would do it as just like a little bit here and there. I had one friend in particular. I still have. She's great, and she'll hire me for Thanks for Doing Time. Jade Ayub Kasti. She's an indie creator for a publishing, indie publisher called Little Foolery. She was with me since pretty much the start. She, you know, had me letter some of her big titles and comics. And every time I worked with her, she was pushing me to try something new, even learn entirely new things. Like, the whole reason I know how to use Adobe InDesign is because she was like, oh, I was going to make an illustrated book, kind of like those old tiny noir magazines with illustrations and story. So you should learn InDesign and then we can put it together. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I do it. Like, some of my most creative stuff was from her. And then I'd say 5 years passed. I would just do these things on the side. A lot of change was going in my life. I was changing careers. I was moving back to the States, all kinds of things. And 5 years on, that's when Sloan picked me up for Prism Stalker. No, it wasn't Prism Stalker. Sloan picked me up for Into the Mountains. And I started working on several Image titles then. I guess Sloan had gotten the recommendation from Jade or had seen me on Tumblr talking about lettering or something. But she had reached out to me on Tumblr, because social media is how we network these days. Mm-hmm. And so I started working on Image titles. Ringside, I think, was one of the longest series I've ever worked on, because it was 15 issues. Usually comics series, I rarely get to do 15 continuous issues. So that's something to think about.
Why do you think that is? Or just in general, because they keep canceling them?
Pretty much in general, because they keep canceling them. The thing is, I don't think no one really notices this pattern as often. So a lot of writers and artists get really excited about their idea, and they put together this huge thing, and there's going to be like, okay, there's going to be this, and be like this, and there's going to be all this stuff happening. And in the back of my mind, it's like very few comics get that long. Very few comics go as far as, say, Preacher or Chew or Walking Dead.
Oh, for sure.
But if you plan out, say, the first four issues, you've got a good pitch for a miniseries. If you present, like, the first 12 issues, then that's going to be a good run of a comic. But I don't know. It's just a rare occurrence for me to get to work on more than 15 issues. The ones that I work on more than 15 continuous issues on nowadays are, like, established titles, like big established stuff, like Detective Comics. And, well, I'm not at 15 issues of Superman yet, but I'm hoping to be.
It ended just shy, but I guess Outpost Zero did make it 14.
It did. Yeah. I think it ended just shy. Like, it definitely felt like we kind of cut it off early, but we still told a good story there. I still enjoyed it very much. I learned so much from that one, for sure. But yeah, it's something to keep in mind if you're making comics, like, are you willing to take your idea and just present it as four issues to start off with and then see where it goes from there?
When you do a book...
When
you do a book like Outpost Zero, like, again, that up till that point would have been the longest kind of consecutive issues on a run that you got to do. So what was your kind of main takeaway from that experience? Do you like working on one project consistently with a fairly consistent creative team, or do you like kind of jumping around? Because some people like being a little bit more mercenary, right? Like, you get to do a lot of different types of projects and a lot of different exposure to different styles, etc. Or did you kind of like being on a consistent book, besides the consistency of a paycheck, so to speak?
I love being on a consistent book, I've got to say. Not just a consistent paycheck. It's just, how do I put it? Lettering is really kind of, I guess coloring can be similar in a way too. But, like, lettering is pretty unique in that, like, the most challenging part of working on a project is the first issue. And that's probably certain for all the other creatives as well. You're trying to get a voice for the comic. But the level of difficulty, like, sinks down to easy mode as soon as you get to the second issue, usually. Because the first issue is me trying to be creative, present a bunch of ideas, see what the team likes, mix the ideas they don't like, put their ideas together into a lettering template. Mm-hmm. And then once I have that lettering template, I just wear it like an old pair of jeans for the rest. Like, I can do creative things within that sphere of that template, but I love consistency. Like, I'm not going to be known as a super wildly creative letterer, and I'm okay with that. I just want to be known as a consistent letterer that can hit deadlines. And that's where my creativity lies, in the problem solving.
I mean, that is what will keep you getting more gigs too, right? Like, at the end of the day, as you say, I think in one of your blog posts, deadlines are everything. And if you can show that you're dependable and you can hit a deadline, that's worth its weight in gold.
Yeah. Like, you could be an absolute rock star of a letterer and reinvent the wheel 10 times over, but that will either limit you to how many books you can do, because that is time consuming, or it will burn you out. Or you know, you'll hit a wall. Or at some point, how do I put this? I was talking about this with other letterers recently. When I decided to go full time, when I got the opportunity from Chris, which I'm always grateful for, it's amazing. And I decided to finally quit my day job I think I was working at Nintendo at the time, and finally work in a job where I felt confident that I knew what I was doing. I knew that I had to give up something for it to become my full time. I don't know if it's true for everyone, but for me, I had to give up something pretty big. And that was a chunk of my passion, a chunk of my really wild creativity, like that extra 120%, like 50%, 15% of that had to go away. Because meeting the deadlines means, as cool an idea as you can have, that cool idea would take a lot of extra chunk when you've got other projects due on your neck that day. you know, I'm not working on one book a week or even one book a day. I'm working on 3 different things to 5 different things a day. And for my ADHD, it just goes haywire. Like, I finally got therapy, and my gosh, that goes a long way. But with juggling that many plates and wanting to meet all those deadlines and being realistic with those deadlines, because I don't think people hire me just because I meet deadlines. It's also, I'm honest when I don't think I can meet a deadline. Mm. When I think, oh, this is getting kind of close to the wire, or I look at my schedule a few weeks out and I'm like, oh, I don't think that's going to be looking good, I reach out to the people I'm working with and I negotiate new dates. And you'd be surprised at how many people don't communicate in comics. No, you won't be surprised, but you can imagine. A lot of people don't want to admit when they're going to be slow because it's a blow to their ego. For me, I had to give up that portion of my ego along with my passion in order to be like, you know, okay, I want to focus and make sure I get this done on time and it looks clean and it looks good and it hits print and all's good, you know?
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, you mentioned Chris, so that's Chris Eliopoulos. So at what point did you become part of virtual calligraphy? Because on his episode, we talked about kind of the origins of virtual calligraphy and what that was or what it is. But obviously, you're a more modern addition to that crew and not from part of that kind of original crew when he first started it. So I'm curious when that opportunity came out for you and what it was like to take that leap.
I'll never forget it because it was a month before the pandemic. It was just a little bit before, like mid-February from what I remember. I was working my day job at Nintendo, which was a place where I love the people I work with. I love the discount at the Nintendo store, and I absolutely hated everything else. Corporate culture is a buzzkill, and I felt like I didn't know what I was doing. They were using my Japanese English skills, but my escape was going home and lettering James Bond in the evenings. Like, that was my way of like shutting my mind off and just enjoying life, was lettering James Bond.
I mean, that's a pretty good escape.
Oh no, it was a fantastic escape. But it was right around that time where I am juggling a lot of hours. I was doing somewhere between 60 to 80 hour weeks. At the same time, I had just met my boyfriend a few months before, and just trying to juggle so many things, figuring out what am I going to do. I had considered the idea, should I just go full-time lettering? And I'm like, oof, no, I think I might have to consider, you know, giving up and just kind of like slowing down and tying up projects and just try to focus on doing a day job. But it was just at that point, Chris emails me out of the blue and he's like, hey, do you want to work for us? Here's what the job entails. And I was like, oh, I need to think about this. And I sat on my hands for like 10 minutes and I'm like, no, I know exactly what I'm gonna do. So I asked him for the weekend to let me think about it so that at least I could tell my boyfriend about it. And when I met up with my boyfriend at the comic book store, because of course he's a big nerd like me, and I sat him down and I'm like, so there's this thing that's gonna like pretty much change our lives forever. And he's like, oh my god, you're pregnant. And I'm like, no. He's like, of course I would think that. He won't let me live that down, but I don't know. I guess I'm dramatic. But I told him about the opportunity, and he's like, you're taking it, aren't you? And I was like, of course I'm taking it. I'm crazy. So I take the opportunity, and I tell my coworkers I'm leaving. I set everything up. We were going to hire someone else to replace me. We were on our last weeks of work, and pandemic hit.
Wow.
And that affected everything. And that was a difficult time to try to know the ropes at Marvel, you know? Like, I was able to leave my old job and join Marvel, but it's like, oh man, you know, Diamond distribution just shut down. We were kind of like left in this weird limbo of things, but the guys at VC were very positive and very welcoming. And Chris and his wife Audra, they looked out for me starting out. They're like, you know, whatever you need, just ask. And Joe Karamanya. Yeah. Joe C. I like to say it because the other one's Joe S. So
there you go.
Joe C. He was my mentor for 6 months. He basically babysat me, I guess, as I learned the ropes and as I learned the Marvel way of lettering, which, looking back on it, it completely changed how I letter comics. 100%. I cannot describe how much of a change it was. It's like when you are like a deviant artist, but then you were sent to art school in Europe or something, right? On a scholarship. Like, all of a sudden you can do things so much differently than before. And I could letter so much faster than before simply because of what he showed me and what he taught me and how he would look over what I lettered and, like, you know, and gave me tips on how to do it in a different way, to do it more in the Marvel way. And I felt so much more confident as a result. And the other guys were so kind to me. They're still so kind to me. They're really good to me. You know, giving me advice whenever I feel lost, helping me out when I need a break or something. Recently I took a month off work so I could move overseas with my husband, who was my boyfriend at the time. Now we're married. We decided to move to Brazil, and that was a massive, massive change in my life. And the guys were able to cover for me for the month that I was away, you know, traveling and wrangling paperwork and settling into our new house. I will always be grateful to them, always.
That's amazing. So I'm curious, in general, working as part of, you know, a lettering studio, like what that actually looks like. Because obviously I've talked with Chris about it, but, you know, he's at the top end. I'm curious what it's like, you know, one of the people actually working in the studio, you know, how, and this is going to sound like a very naive question, but like, how are assignments working? Like, is it something where, are you getting these gigs directly, or is it all kind of being funneled through the studio and then they're kind of farming it out to, you know, to each of the people working for the studio? Like, I'm very curious because I naively don't really understand how that part works.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do things two different ways, because on one hand, I am still an available freelance letterer, so I do take on freelance work, but at a very, very limited amount, so it does not affect my Marvel work.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, I'm the one who is fielding emails and deciding whether to accept or reject projects for myself. And a lot of times I reject projects because I don't, like I said, I love doing ongoing work, but I don't like taking on new work because it's so much extra work to do that first issue. And it takes a lot of time to make sure, you know, it looks right. But when people come with the right project for me, I'll accept them. But when it's something that I don't think I can handle in my workload, I have this long list of other letters in the industry that I've collected over the years that I will recommend to people and pretty much tailor fit to whatever their project is. Because sometimes I know for a fact, just as a cold, straightforward fact, that sometimes people hire me because I'm a good letterer, but there's a lot of times that people hire me because I'm a girl letterer, or I'm a queer letterer, or something like that. And it's like, okay, I know what you actually want, because you guys want to put together like an all-girl creative team. Okay, I know who to recommend for you. That kind of thing, right? It's just one of those things where you kind of know people's angle and you kind of think of what they like. And when it's someone with a really, really cool project, like I really want to work on that project, but I can't, like, feasibly, I do not have the time to, I have a special list of people who are like my favorites, of like, this is someone who I think their lettering is better than mine, or just would knock this out of the park and make a really cool comic. Those are the people, like, I have a special list for. So that's how I handle assignments on my own, right?
Okay.
And then how I handle assignments with DC is that Chris gives us a list of what's upcoming, and he gives us our assignments. He pretty much tells us what we want. And if we want, if there's something like, oh, that's an ongoing from what I was doing before, we can talk about it and trade amongst ourselves before we sit down. And then we just kind of like go with that list of our assignments. And we have a way of all chatting together and discussing whenever anything is going on any given day. Sometimes we're just casually, you know, water cooler talk, you know, talking about the latest Marvel movie or whatever. But sometimes it's like, oh, we need this and this for this week's books or whatever. You know, things that are just regular shop talk that you would expect from any office.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about a piece of recent work that you've done, and along the lines of, you know, kind of a first issue or like a one-shot kind of issue where you do have to kind of establish a tone. So you did the Jackpot book.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious about that one because you have a character who is pre-existing, well, very pre-existing, mm-hmm. but obviously, and is also coming out of recent events in the Amazing Spider-Man book, which I believe Joe is the letterer for. And so, but now you're taking mm-hmm. on that character in their own book. What is it like to adapt or develop the letters there? Because you're playing within a, you know, a set style, so to speak, in terms of the spider world, but you also are making it unique mm-hmm. for this character. So I'm curious what that was like to develop.
That was an interesting one because I knew Jackpot would lead into Jackpot and Black Cat, which I'm currently lettering.
Mm-hmm.
And Black Cat is a series that was being lettered by someone outside of DC for a while and then got handed to me while Jig McKay was working on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was also a series where I was working on, but I didn't have the feedback from the previous letterer on the style and stuff. So I just had to look at the previous issue and try to, and since there were things that I could not emulate with the style, I wasn't as technically talented as the previous letter. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna have to do this in a slightly different way. So I developed my own lettering style for Black Cat that would not seem too jarring from the previous style.
Okay.
And then I lettered a few Black Cat books like that. And then Jackpot came along, and I knew Jackpot was going to lead into Jackpot and Black Cat. But I also knew Jackpot was coming from Spider-Man. So I talked to Joe, and I asked him about the style, and he shared all the info I needed on that. And that's how I knew about her, like, orange caption boxes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, okay, so I'll just mix the two styles of how the caption boxes are for Black Widow, which is a white and black gradient with a white outline and a little icon, and then Jackpot is going to be like an orange and light gradient with an outline. So trying to make them look like they both belong in equal measure in the same book, and at the same time still keeping to that similar color scheme as is being used in Spider-Man, so that when someone is jumping between Spider-Man and Jackpot, they're not going to feel like it's too off the mark.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can still have some of its unique personality in those details, but I'm kind of comforted by the fact that people don't notice the lettering too much, and it gives me a little bit of leeway to just be slightly different, and it's a-okay.
A question that, like, it's only, I think, when you really start to think about the lettering, and so, again, as a layperson, it doesn't happen as often, unfortunately, but, like, some of the, I'm specifically talking about, what issue am I looking at here? I'm looking at Jackpot on Black Cat number one, so you have a few different sound effects that are kind of colored a certain way, like, for example, like, when they're texting to each other, and you kind of have the boop-boop. What kind of thought process goes in there to develop what color would be appropriate for that kind of sound effect? It sounds like a silly question, but I'm very curious what goes into that, because you think about it and you just kind of go past it. But if you really think about it, I'm curious about the choice in colors. Like, even later on, when you have Jackpot's You know what I mean? Like the ding, ding, ding. You know what I mean? But like you have different, you use different color effects with the different ding, ding, ding. So I'm curious what led into that process as well. Because again, it's one of those things where as a reader, you might go right past it, but obviously it's done with intent. So I'm curious what the intent was.
Yeah, my sound effects process is interesting because, I don't know. I think it's one easy way to find out if a book is lettered by me is if you see the sound effects, because I tend, even though sometimes I'll use gradients and other kind of little tricks and things, I have a tendency to just keep the sound effects to two colors at most for the most part of the process. Sometimes I'll have gradients, but for the most part, I'll just keep to two tones because I like the sound effects being much more a part of the art than something big with like a drop shadow that kind of pops right off the artwork, because I feel like that makes the artwork feel more flat as a result. Like if you have this sound effect and it has this big shadow behind it and it's just like boom popping out everywhere, then you'll notice the sound effect, but then the artwork behind it might look a little flat. So as part of efficiency and as part of just me developing a style that I feel most comfortable with, I usually keep it as usually an outline color and a filler color that are complementary but don't clash too badly, but still make each other pop. And so like sometimes white outlines with a bright, like a dark fill or something, it'll be simple, it'll pop out and people will notice it, and that works. When it's electronics, or I guess one good example is lightsabers in Star Wars. I do the High Republic, and for throughout lettering the High Republic, I tend to keep the lightsaber colors matching their lightsabers, and it's usually white and green for the green lightsabers. So it'll be like a big white fill with these green outlines, so it kind of has this electric look to it. So I'm often thinking in that regard. That's usually my approach. As to how I choose the colors, I have a tendency to select the color swatch on the page after seeing the lettered page, and either use it as a complementary color that's in the sound effect or something, or I choose a color that contrasts that so that the sound effect will pop, you know? Like if you have a dark blue background, I'll choose yellow to pop off the blue, but depending on how loud I want that sound effect to look like, I'll decide how bright I want that yellow to be, because I don't want something that is so bright a primary color that it'll just look like it doesn't belong on that page. Like I'm constantly trying to think of what would work best on the page and how will it not be too jarring. Well, at the same time, you'll know where to look if you think there's a sound effect there. Like I don't want them to disappear, but at the same time, I don't want them to distract from the artwork.
Who would you say are your biggest lettering influences in terms of, you know, the letters that have meant either the most for you in terms of being able to see how they put it on a page, or, you know, maybe it's just someone taking the time to actually teach you, like you said, in terms of that kind of impact, in terms of understanding and learning the Marvel method in terms of Marvel lettering. Like who out there is the biggest influence, you think, on the way that you want your letters to look?
That's a hard question because there's a lot of people I can choose from on that one. I think it depends on where I'm coming from on that. Like if it's from childhood inspiration, it would be Chris. If it's from approaching things with the Marvel method, it would be all of the VC guys, especially Josie, because they showed me how to do it the Marvel way. They showed me how to approach things, and often I get my best ideas when seeing how they've done the process or from what they've shared with me on a book they've lettered that I'm lettering something, you know, adjacent to, and I need to know the style. I learned something new in that process. But for my indie stuff or just like in the past several years to getting to this point, I'd say Aditya Bidikar and Hassan for sure. I've seen both of their works. They do things. Aditya and Hassan are both major influences on my lettering, because they both approach their lettering in really unique ways that I cannot hope to emulate. There's a lot of Photoshop in the process. There's a lot of hand lettering in the process. And there's a lot of creativity as a result. So I never try to emulate them, but they always give me really great ideas on like how to approach things without being too rigid. And that especially helped me when Detective Comics, Aditya was working on Detective Comics, but he was taking a step back from some major work, and they wanted him to do a 12-issue storyline called The Tower by Mariko Tamaki, and each issue was going to come out each week. So it was 12-week stretch of constant Detective Comics. And he noped out of that. He was like, and I totally understand if I was in his position. But I was in my position, so I don't know if it was him who recommended or someone who recommended, but somehow I got invited. So I got invited to work on Detective Comics, which I will admit was my dream come true. Like, I always think of that as like the cream of the crop, like, oh my gosh, bucket list, but never actually thinks it's ever going to happen. Is Detective Comics. And so of course I said yes, of course I would do it, even if it was a new issue every week for 12 weeks straight. I was eager to do it, but I was also terrified out of my mind. And it was him who I reached out to, since he was the previous ongoing letterer and he was on his way out. I was like, okay, is there anything you can share with me? And he shared with me his template, which is amazing. To share your lettering template is basically to share your entire toolbox for that comic you're working on. Mm-hmm. And that gave me the tools that I built out the most elaborate template I've ever worked on. And still to this day is the most elaborate template I have on hand of Batman, you know? I ended up working on that series since that 12-issue run for, oh gosh, I don't know how many issues I've been on it.
It's been a while.
Let me take a... It's been a little while. It's been just a couple of years now. Give me one second. Let me look this up. I have to say I've been on this for roughly 36 issues, I'd say.
Wow.
Yeah. That's quite a... Yeah. So... in the process, I've been developing and upgrading and updating that template for forever now, and it is ridiculously complex. There's so much stuff on there. All of the Batman characters have different caption styles. Mm-hmm. All of them have little icons associated with them. I have way too much fun with it. When I say that, like, I give up some of my passion, sometimes that passion comes back into something and it channels hard into it, and that's part of what I did. And a big part of that was both Aditya and Clayton, who works on Batman, he also lent me a hand too and gave me advice and showed me his templates. So I ended up developing off that as well. So both of them just like saved my life on that, and I was able to knock out those 12 issues without dying. And because I met those really hard deadlines, I think they just haven't thought to get rid of me yet. So, small blessing. Big blessing.
What is it like? So you get to do Detective Comics, and then you get to do a pretty well-regarded, heralded kind of relaunch of the Superman series. So now you're doing, you know, the other side of DC's street. You went to the dark side, now you're in the light side. How, and I guess the same type of thing, right? Like you get to start off with Superman 1, so obviously the character already has an established iconography in terms of its letters, but also you're establishing a tone for a new book. So is it a little bit of the same where you have to kind of build an infrastructure but also adapt what had previously been accepted? Because as you said, you don't want it to be someone to pick up Superman and feel like, whoa, this feels different. Like you don't want it to be too different, but also you want it distinctive at the same way. It's I guess it must be an incredibly tough needle to thread.
Superman number one was should have been a tough needle to thread, and at times it was super, super intimidating because one of my favorite creative teams was putting it together. The artist is incredible, and I'm just looking because when they handed me the pages, the letter is already fully colored for that first issue, and I'm just like sitting there mind blown being like, how do I approach this? And it was actually not a painful process to build it out because when I read the script, it made me realize that they wanted to approach this with like a fresh slate, like a fresh start. They wanted something new and hopeful without a lot of baggage. So I wasn't going to be too concerned about like what was done before, as long as I'm adhering to the style of what's going on right now. So the way I do Superman's captions are different than Action Comics. A lot of things I do are different than Action Comics, but I'm still trying to give the same tone of Superman, so it doesn't feel like anything's too off the mark. But at the same time, Detective Comics informed me a lot on how to build out voices, like for a major DC property. Like, you've got to make sure all the characters have a special voice to them, so in like special caption boxes and things like that. So it allowed me to work in a playground I've already established the boundaries of. So when I finally set up my template for that first issue of Superman, I felt pretty good, and I was like, okay, I think I can just keep going this way, and that's been fun to do, even though the artist has changed over to different artists and things like that. I still wanted to have that through line with the lettering that yes, this is the Superman comic. So I think that worked out pretty well, and recently we're working on something new, and it involves you know, me talking to Dave the letter for Action Comics and just kind of collaborating on a few ideas, because we both want to achieve some consistency in a certain element that's bleeding over between. So getting to talk to another letter on another book is a rare opportunity, but something I really, really appreciate editors allowing letters to do, because whenever letters are allowed to communicate like we do with our studio at Marvel, letters can build off each other on ideas. Like, it's not something that you have to be precious to what you've developed, you know? You can be open and share things with each other and make something better in the process. I think it's maybe because lettering is an art, but it is an art dependent on the creativity of other people on the team as well. Like, lettering alone will not sell a book, but the lettering, when it's good, will help make that book shine. And as always being a part of a team, you kind of have to go into comics with a collaborative mindset. You have to go into comics without ego, because the ego will either set you back or make you miss deadlines, you know? The ego, when it comes to letters, I think is more damaging than helpful in any regard.
So the last question I'll ask you, I'm just curious in terms of, you know, we talked about those other two kind of major DC books, and then you're also doing a book like Fire and Ice, Welcome to Smallville, which is very different and just a tremendous amount of fun. So I'm curious what it's like to letter that book, because it's got a very different visual aesthetic. It's much more, I don't want to say cartoony, because I don't mean it in a bad way, but it feels more animated. It feels more animated and a little bit more playful. So what is it like to then adapt letters for an art style like that, which does feel different than your kind of cornerstone DC when you're at Superman or Detective Comics?
It's unique because of getting to work with Andrea Shea. Andrea Shea is one of the editors at DC, and I worked with her on books previously, most especially the Crush and Lobo. And Lobo series.
Okay.
Yeah. So I worked on Crush and Lobo with Andrea before, and she was someone who is very hands-on as an editor, who's very involved and is always communicative and making sure the whole team is on the same page and make it feel like we all have our own share in the effort. And I really love that about her as an editor. She's like, I've told DC before, it's like, if she's on a book and she wants me on it, then she's got a good chance. Because she's amazing to work with, because she, similar to working with my friend Jade, she has this drive about her where she will think of an idea and put it on my shoulders and be like, you can do this. And I'll be like, what? And I was like, oh, I can do this. Okay. So when it came with Fire and Ice, she was like, okay, this is what I have in mind. And she sends me all these ideas from like the original Justice League International and like different kinds of styles. And she's like, can you do this and this and this? And make me take a step back and be like, I don't know if I could do that. But every other time Andrea's asked me to do something wild, I've managed it. So I guess I'll do that. And I ended up having a lot of fun with it. There was like weird little elements and details. Like she wanted me to do little titles for each of the characters being introduced, as if they were doing, but the scene is as if they were in like The Bachelor or something, and they're doing private interviews, but they're doing private interviews from like a bathroom. I had to put these little caption things on the side. She's sending me this screenshot of The Bachelor with the little like title caption on the corner. It's like, can you do something like that? And I was like, I have no idea. Let's do it anyways, I guess. And things would turn out okay. I was like, oh, all right. So Fire and Ice was special to me. Fire and Ice was very, very fun, for sure.
It's an incredibly charming, fun book. And your letters are a perfect marriage to that, because, as I said, like, you have to find a way to channel what you're seeing on the page, and it has to work in a way that feels consistent. And as you said, like, you know, a lot of people will not recognize good lettering, but they'll recognize bad lettering. And so it's definitely, it's lettering that feels very apropos of what you're reading and of the visual style, which again is so unique and special. And like, I found as I get older, I appreciate the whimsy and the fun of comics more, because I found, like, you know, I went through my 20s and I wanted, you know, I love David Finch and something like that with uber rendering, and everything felt so serious. You had Frank D'Armata on colors, that kind of stuff. But as I got older, I'm like, I really like fun. Like, I want to see comics be fun again. And so being able to have books like Welcome to Smallville, it's really refreshing to see a sense of fun and whimsy, because at times, I mean, as much as I like Detective Comics, it's not really high on the whimsy.
Yeah, no, exactly. Getting to do Crush and Lobo and Fire and Ice and like the a lot of the Pride short stories for DC and Marvel, there's a lot of whimsy to them. They're super fun. There's a series that I don't know if a lot of people know about, but Chris Hastings wrote it. It was called The $6 Million Man, and it was for Dynamite. And I'll always remember that as being one of the more whimsical books I've ever worked on, back when I used to work on Dynamite titles, because he was in the $6 Million Man Goes to Japan.
Okay.
And there's a lot of characters who are either speaking Russian or Japanese. And since there are so many scenes where characters were speaking in Japanese, I ended up calling my friend Zach Davidson, who is a well-known comic book translator for, you know, Gigi.Dottle or the all these like major comics. I think Devilman, I think he also worked on several comics involving cats. It's just tons of yokai comics. He's a great person. He's the one who introduced me to my husband. So we're good friends. And I told him, it's like, hey, there's this gig I'm doing, and they're in Japan a lot. And they're just trying to Google translate the text, and I don't think that's going to cut. Like, I'm not going to translate. I'm done with my translation days. What do you think? And so he gets hired onto the book as well to translate several parts of the book into Japanese. And then I got to letter that in Japanese into the book. And it was really weird, and it was really unique. And I'm sure it was very frustrating to people who couldn't read Japanese, but it wasn't supposed to, you weren't supposed to read it if you didn't know how to read it. You're just supposed to get the vibe. But I ended up having so much fun because we did like sound effects in Japanese. We did other things. It was a goofy mini series, and it still sits in my heart as one of those, like, that was special. And then another mini series that was really special and cartoony for me was Flavor. It was colored by Tanra Bondolin, and she did it in this style where it almost looked like the texture of a watercolor painting, but it was also the color choices and thick lines as you would see with cell drawn art. I can't describe it well, but it was fun and it was cute, and it was cut off way too soon. We never got to finish like a full storyline on it, and that's the moment that comics kind of showed me, oh yeah, you can really love a series and it won't be successful. And it's like, ow. I learned that pretty early on, but that was like, oof. But that one was whimsical too.
Well, Ariana, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today about your entry to the industry, your love of early 90s Uncanny X-Men, which I am also there with you, your love of Age of Apocalypse. Also, I'm a huge fan of that, so that I agree with you. That's kind of my Star Wars as well in terms of big comic book massive events that really imprinted upon me, so that I can especially appreciate. And loving your current work and as part of Virtual Calligraphy, and also on Superman and Detective Comics, it's great work as well. So thank you so much for coming and chatting about that with me today.
Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much.
I'm sorry for talking so much.
Not at all. This is perfect.